A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 11, The Triumph of the Greeks, Salamis and Plataea.
During the winter, and in the months following, Mardonius made very attractive offers in an attempt to detach Athens from the Greek alliance, promising Athens that everything that had been destroyed would be restored, and that under Persian hegemony, Athens would dominate Greece. The Athenians, however, resisted that, and as the spring of 479 came, because the Athenians had resisted, Mardonius decided that they and the alliance would have to be subdued by force. The Spartans, meanwhile, safe back in the Peloponnese, were reluctant to venture out for whatever reason or array of reasons. And finally, the Athenians, to get the Spartans moving, at least from their own perspective, threatened to defect to Persia unless Sparta would come and help them face the threat of Mardonius's very substantial army. Well, this time, the Spartans came out in force as never before and never afterwards. They came out with 5,000 full homoioi or spartiates, another 5,000 perioikic hoplites who were trained in Spartan methods from the various communities which formed part of Laconia, but were not full Spartan citizens, and supposedly with 7 helot attendants for each, to be used, if necessary, as light troops, for a total Laconian contingent of somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000. The combined Spartan, predominantly Spartan, but also Athenian, and indeed with other contingents, the combined Greek force encamped itself just over the border of Attica in Boeotia, on the northern slope of Mount Kithaeron, with the Persians below in the valley, where, as always, Persian cavalry would be most effective, very near the city, or the small polis of Plataea. And there they waited for a week and longer in the high summer heat, neither side willing to give up its advantage, the Persians not wanting to disadvantage themselves by leaving the plain to engage the Greeks in their position, the Greeks unwilling to engage the Persians on the downslope where the Persian cavalry would be most effective. Finally, the Persians began to make use of their cavalry to attack Greek supply trains coming over the mountain passes, and ultimately, again, they succeeded in fouling the spring on which the Greeks were primarily dependent for water as they were waiting in preparation for battle. At that point, the leader of the coalition forces, the Spartan regent Pausanias, Leonidas, you'll remember, had died at Thermopylae the year before. His son, Pleistarchos, he and Gorgo's son, was a minor, nowhere near an age where he could lead troops into battle himself, so Cleombrotus's son, the previous king's son, Pausanias was leading the Spartan forces and the combined forces as regent. Pausanias decided, in view of their supply problems and also in view of their water problems, that the Greeks needed to redeploy during the night. And what exactly happened in this battle? I've read every account that I know of, and to the best of my knowledge, no one knows precisely. But the Greek withdrawal and redeployment somehow went awry, and the Greek forces were, to some considerable degree, in disarray when morning broke and when the Persians attacked, along with Theban allies and other allies. One group of Spartans, according to Herodotus, led by a diehard by the name of Amompharatos, refused to move, which was breaking up the Spartan line on the grounds that Spartans should never retreat. And it took Pausanias a very long and dangerous time, by all accounts, to get Amompharatos to do what they were supposed to do. The Persians attacked the Greek lines in disarray, but difficult though it was, the Spartans in particular held, finally won the day, and took the Persian camp, a major part of the Persian forces. Once they saw how the battle was going, refused to deploy and took off for the Hellespont on their way back to Asia. At the very first chance, Mardonius was killed, and for all practical purposes, the threat of the Persians in Greece was at an end. Pausanias afterwards was invited by some of his allies to mutilate the corpse of Mardonius, as the corpse of Leonidas had been mutilated. He refused to do that. And when they looted the Persian camp, they saw the splendid dinners and splendid dinner service and the luxury with which the Persians had been served, and he, amazed, supposedly, had the Helot retainers of the Spartans make an ordinary Spartan dinner just so that everybody could contemplate the contrast and wonder what on earth the Persians were trying to do when they had so much wealth, trying to conquer a land which was so much poorer than Persia was itself. On the same day, purportedly, the other Spartan king, Leotychidas, who had replaced, you'll recall, Demaratos, in conjunction with the father of Pericles, Xanthippus, the name means yellow horse, were in command of forces in Asia Minor, in what's now Turkey, where they fought a combined land and sea battle at Mycale and also defeated the Persians. And with that, Herodotus concludes his history of the Greek and Persian wars. And there, traditionally, people have considered the Greek and Persian wars to have ended. History, though, doesn't always move in such finely rounded periods. And the day after, let us say, December 7th, 1941, was perhaps in some sense, for Americans and Japanese at least, a new world, but was also Monday, December 8th, 1941, when people went to work and continued doing whatever they ordinarily did. So here, too, it took actually longer for the Greek and Persian mutual hostilities to end, and indeed, perhaps they weren't brought to a decisive conclusion until the conquests of Alexander the Great a century and a half later. In any case, after the events of 479, Sparta, still leading the Greek alliance, from a Greek perspective, liberated Cyprus and Byzantium. But in the meantime, from a Spartan perspective at least, Pausanias was beginning to get too big for his britches and was beginning to antagonize the other folks in the alliance. There was a commemorative column which was made in honor of the Greek defense of Persia. The remains of it still exist in what's now Istanbul. And it says, in suitable laconic terms, these fought in the war, and names all the poleis which, in fact, did fight in the war, beginning with, of course, Lacedaemon or Sparta. Pausanias saw fit to add a little personal note highlighting his own contribution to the cause, which when the Spartans found out about, they horrifiedly made him get rid of. And indeed, in the next phase of the proceedings, the Spartans had other problems as well, as they continued anti-Persian operations. Not only was Pausanias recalled to Sparta to explain his behavior within a year of his great triumph, so too King Leotychidas was exiled when the Spartans found that he had been embezzling funds while on campaign against Medizing Thessaly in the north of Greece. All of this misbehavior of one sort or another led the remaining allies to decide that they preferred being led by Athens rather than Sparta in anti-Persian operations. And indeed, 478 to 77, that school year or Greek year in effect, saw the formation of the Delian League, originally headquartered at the sacred island of Delos, supposedly the birthplace of Apollo in the mid-Aegean, which was designed, again, to continue the fight against the Persians and certainly to prevent the Persians from causing further troubles in and for Greece, and which in the end became, in effect, an Athenian empire, though that process took the better part of 50 years. Meanwhile, and very interestingly, from very early on, Themistocles, the great, brilliant, and unscrupulous Athenian leader, seems to have come to the decision that once Salamis was passed, the greatest threat to Athens was not Persia, but was in fact Sparta. As the most influential commander at Salamis, he spent the winter of 480-79 in Sparta, being feted by the Spartans when they voted to determine which person among the commanders of the Greek fleet at Salamis had been most influential and valuable. And this is typically ancient Greek. The story goes that every commander voted for himself first, but every commander also voted for Themistocles second, except for Themistocles himself, who, of course, voted for himself first, which is pretty compelling proof that, in fact, Themistocles was the dominant leader, at least in that campaign. Sparta, to some degree, and Sparta's allies even more at this point, did not want Athens to rebuild her walls. Sparta at that point did not feel particularly threatened by Athens. The other allies evidently did, in part, I presume, because of Athens' now very impressive naval power. Themistocles, while he was at Sparta, hemmed and hawed, played for time, having encouraged the Athenians in the meanwhile to build up the walls before the Spartans knew about it, which they did. And then, and only then, did Themistocles reveal to the Spartans that Athens, thank you very much, will do what Athens thinks is best for herself, not what anybody else thinks is best for Athens. The Spartans, at that point, put up with it. He also, according to Thucydides, at the same period, made a proposal, more or less secretly, saying it would be very dishonorable but of immense value to Athens, that now that they'd conquered the Persians, the best thing that the Athenians could do would be to burn the ships of every other polis in the Greek fleet, so that Athens would have absolutely uncontested hegemony at sea. Themistocles, again, was an unscrupulous character, as well as a brilliant character. He also, evidently, during the 470s, was not only feted in Sparta, one presumes with less enthusiasm after the Spartans found out that the walls had been built, but he also spent his time stirring up trouble for Sparta covertly as much as he could among the various other poleis of the Peloponnese, again, all with a view toward his conviction that the long-term threat to Athens was not now Persia, but was Sparta. And indeed, all such ideas and activities in view, it may be no surprise to learn, Themistocles was ultimately ostracized from Athens and spent the last years of his life happily in the employ of the great king of Persia, the person who did most to thwart the Persian invasion of Greece, ended his life on the Persian payroll. So perhaps those messages which he had sent to Xerxes paid off after all. In any event, by 477, Sparta had withdrawn from anti-Persian activity, as through the Delian League and in other venues the Athenians came to dominate. Pausanias, though, after having been recalled to Sparta and not convicted for malfeasance, the Spartans were very reluctant to convict full Spartans of much of anything, in part because they were always in short supply, and Pausanias, whatever his flaws, was clearly an effective commander, and at the time people thought a very effective commander. Most of the credit to the decisive victory at Plataea did, in fact, go to him. So they were reluctant to push matters too far, and he went back to the Hellespont and began to medize a bit himself with a view towards ensuring his own power. He was not, after all, king and was unlikely ever to become king. Sometime around 470, about the time that Themistocles himself headed off to Persia, activities of this kind on the part of Pausanias came to the ears of the Spartan authorities, even more damaging. There were rumors that he was intriguing with the Helots, trying to bring about a Helot rebellion, which was always Sparta's greatest fear. So once he was recalled from Byzantium and came back to Sparta, somehow or other he was tipped off when he was going to be hauled in for punishment. As they were physically coming to do it, so the story goes, he saw them, read their body language or whatever, and fled to the main temple of Athena at Sparta, where he took refuge. having got in trouble, as they imagined, various times in the past for violating the sanctity of such places of refuge, the Spartans did not drag him out, supposedly led by his mother, who was disgusted with his behavior. They instead walled him in, and he starved to death. In order to avoid polluting the sanctuary, as they were peeking in when they saw that he was near death, very near death, they pulled him out so he wouldn't die in the sanctuary and pollute it. But that was the rather sad and sorry end of the victor at Plataea Pausanias. He was rehabilitated subsequently, and in later centuries, not immediately, they had shrines both to Pausanias and Leonidas at Sparta. But in the short run, Leonidas certainly came to a more glorious end. Meanwhile, Athens, with great enthusiasm, was continuing operations against Persia. And if we had better sources for this period, these conflicts would be much more famous than in fact they are. They involve numbers of ships entirely comparable to those at Salamis. Sometime around 467, Cimon, or Simon, K-I or C-I-M-O-N, the pro-Spartan leader in Athens, the son of Miltiades, who was the main victor at Marathon, led Athenian forces to a crushing naval victory in southern Turkey over Persian-Phoenician forces at the Battle of Eurymedon. Later on, in the 450s, the Athenians detached 200-odd ships and a huge expeditionary force to support an anti-Persian rebellion in Egypt. They finally lost all those ships, but though we don't know a great deal about these events, we do know that the Athenian foreign policy, at least, was very activist at this time. Despite Themistocles' efforts, though, up through the 460s, largely through the mediation of figures like Cimon, who was so much an admirer of Sparta that he called his own son Lacedaemonicus, or in other words, Spartan boy or Spartan. The Athenians and Spartans, or some factions within Athens and Sparta, were committed to the notion that Athens and Sparta were like two well-matched horses working together for the benefit of Greece. That policy came a cropper, and the beginnings of serious ill feeling between Sparta and Athens, which led to serious conflict between Sparta and Athens, came to a head in the aftermath of a crushing earthquake in Sparta, probably in 464. We are told that something like 20,000 Spartans were killed, which was a very, very substantial portion of the citizen body. Also killed were several whole age classes undergoing the agoge, who were killed when the buildings in which they were working out just collapsed and crushed every single one of them. The immediate result of the earthquake, besides the extensive loss of life in Sparta, was a helot revolt of unprecedented severity and ferocity. As soon as it became clear that the Spartans had taken a hit, the helots, especially in Messenia, but also in Laconia as well, revolted and very, very nearly took Sparta itself then and there. Relatively new on the throne and replacing the disgraced Leotychidas was the Spartan king, Archidamus, and he evidently mobilized enough resistance to maintain Sparta for the moment, but the full suppression of this Helot revolt took Sparta, depending on which manuscript tradition or which interpretation of the manuscript tradition you're inclined to support, took either 4 years or 10 years. Most authorities incline to four. As it progressed, the Messenian Helot rebels held a stronghold at a place called Ithome, which was a very strong natural position, and the Spartans had not studied much or specialized much in siegecraft, and they thought the Athenians might well be better at such things, and they invited the Athenians to help them suppress the Helots. Cimon was still very much in influence in Athens. He was pro-Spartan. He came with 4,000 Athenian hoplites. And the real break in Spartan and Athenian relations supposedly came when, after the Athenian hoplites had come to help out, they were horrified by the condition of the Helots in Sparta, and the Spartans decided to send them and nobody else who had come to help them home. They were afraid that the Athenians, democrats that they were sympathizing with the Helots and were a subversive force. The Athenians were furious. Cimon himself was ostracized. His policy was in ruins. And very shortly thereafter began the so-called First Peloponnesian War, which went on in a kind of desultory way for about 15 years, the most decisive action of which was sometime in 458-57, the Battle of Tanagra, which was a narrowly run Spartan victory over the Athenian alliance. In 446, Sparta negotiated the so-called 30 years peace with Athens and the Athenian alliance, but it did not, in fact, last 30 years. And in fact, by 431, Athens and Sparta saw the beginning of what we know as the Peloponnesian War, which would result in the destruction of the Athens of the age of Pericles, when it finally concluded, and which would mark, in some sense, the end, if not of the great age, of the greatest age, in any case, of ancient Greece. The beginnings of the Peloponnesian War are, in fact, very, very complicated, and the immediate occasions for dispute had to do with Athenian colony in North Greece, Potidaea, relatively near Mount Athos, where past expeditions had come to grief, and important to Athens in large part because it was close enough to the Hellespont to be a good place to hold if you wanted to protect your grain supply, and even more a dispute between Corinth, a longtime Spartan ally, and generally a faithful Spartan ally, as we know, and their colony, Corcyra or Corfu, which had become a major naval power in its own right. And the Corcyrans tried to engineer Athenian help in their disputes against Corinth, but because Corinth was allied with Sparta, Sparta was at least tangentially involved as well. And as Thucydides says, boiling down what was in fact a very complicated situation, the real reason for the war was, in the intervening years since the conclusion of the Persian Wars, a generation or two before, the balance of power had shifted. what had begun as the Delian League had become, in effect, an Athenian seaborne empire, with virtually all, just a few exceptions, contributing members of the league or empire, providing Athens not with ships of their own, but with monetary payments, which the Athenians used in large part to fund their own navy, and in no insubstantial measure, especially after transferring the league treasury from Delos to Athens, to fund their own projects, not least famous among them the building program which culminated in the Parthenon itself at this time. Some of the allies, unsurprisingly, objected to their money being used on purposes which, so far as they could see, had no immediate relevance to defense against Persia. The Athenians basically said, you see any Persians lately? Then what's your problem? You're getting your money's worth. Shut up and behave. And not much more nicely than that. By this time, membership in the alliance was, from an Athenian perspective, not voluntary. As the Athenians themselves said, indeed, as Pericles himself said, according to Thucydides, it may not have been right for us to gain an empire, but it would be, in effect, suicidal for us to let it go once we've gained it. So for good or for ill, they were committed. They had become ever more prosperous with its less venturesome foreign policy. Sparta had not. Sparta had previously been the dominant power in Greece. The Athenians were gaining in power more and more every year. And as the Corinthians, according to Thucydides, pointed out, the Athenians are the kind of people who can't themselves stay still, who are always ambitious and in motion, and they're also the kind of people who won't let anybody else alone. You've got to deal with these people. They are becoming a public nuisance. And the Spartans, finally, though reluctantly, came to concur. Their king, Archidamus, who had proved his mettle in the Helot revolt after the earthquake, argued for waiting. Let's not get into something before we're ready. Athens is pretty formidable foe. We don't want to push this. The ephors, most notably according to Thucydides, an ephor with the wonderful name of Sthenelaidas, thought differently, and Sparta, in fact, did declare war, as they put it themselves, again quoting Thucydides, in order to liberate Athens' allies from the yoke of the tyrant city, which sounded very good in Sparta. That was traditional Spartan work, and at least from a Spartan perspective, they were very good at it.
This ends Lecture 11.